Hi there, and thanks for turning on The Blender, the weekly podcast from Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. I'm Pavel Botorin, I'm a producer here at RFE, and I'll be your host this week. Before we start, let me just take a minute and say this. REM broke up, you know, the theme song, Radio Free Europe. So the band that wrote it broke up. They issued a statement at their website saying, "To anyone who ever felt touched by our music, our deepest thanks for listening." Well, they've had a pretty good run. We're all big fans here at The Blender. And thank you, Michael Stipe, for our theme song. Okay, now on to important things. Today, we're going to talk about dictators. You know, despots, autocrats, tyrants, strongmen. Remember the opening scene of The Naked Gun? You know, Frank Drebin fighting Ayatollah Khomeini, Gaddafi, Castro. So yes, those guys. I do think that our image of dictators come to a large degree from the show business, TV shows, comedies, what have you. But what are these people like in real life? What unites them? Is there a unifying characteristic inherent to every autocratic leader? There is a new book out titled The Dictator's Handbook, Why Bad Behavior is Almost Always Good Politics. My colleague and co-host of this show, Grant Padelko, interviewed one of the authors of this fascinating book, Alistair Smith, and he had a few interesting things to say about dictators in general, about the Arab Spring, Syria, Libya, particularly Libya, Muammar Gaddafi's regime and the new transitional government that has replaced him.
Could be a lot of bloodshed and there'll be another dictator, and I think maybe in 5 years' time, all that will be different is the lack of colorful clothes.
So we're going to listen to that interview first, but then I'm going to talk with our own Golnaz Esfandiari about what Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad has tried to achieve with his current trip to New York to the United Nations.
Under his presidency, the economy has gotten worse and the country is facing more and more problems. But President Ahmadinejad, instead of finding some solutions, he comes to New York with this plan to reform the global management.
Golnaz and I also talked about why Ahmadinejad is accompanied by a controversial aide on this trip, someone who is accused of embezzlement in Iran. But first, let's listen to Alistair Smith. He's a professor of politics at NYU, and together with Bruce Bueno de Mesquita, also a professor at NYU, he wrote The Dictator's Handbook, Why Bad Behavior is Almost Always Good Politics. Let me just read this for you from the cover. The Dictator's Handbook offers a crash course in taking and holding on to power that any dictator, CEO, or president should take to heart. Alistair Smith was kind enough to speak about this crash course for all aspiring dictators with our web editor and Blender host, Grant Padelko.
Welcome to The Blender, Alistair Smith.
Very pleased to be with you.
First of all, why don't you tell me, why did you and Bruce Bueno de Mesquita write this book?
Well, we've been working, trying to understand the system of government for a project for 18 years. So it sort of came out of conversations over lunch about why was it that leaders would go to war, and people always traditionally think about the big issues of balance of power and national interest and security concerns, and we were just like, no, why does a particular leader get up one day and decide to go to war or not? And we just thought, well, maybe it matters to them, and it all came out of conversations about what were the consequences for political leaders of fighting wars, winning wars, and losing wars. And it turned out, it's sort of bizarre to us that nobody had actually ever thought about what are the consequences for individual leaders of the decisions they make. And so for the last 18 years, we've been elaborating from that simple theme that leaders are the guys who make the decisions, and they all want to keep power. They want to come to power, stay in power, keep power, accumulate wealth for themselves, get discretion. And how does that happen in different political systems? And this turns out we can explain huge swathes of politics, from democracies to autocracies to churches to political organizations and FIFA, just with this simple structure of thinking of the question of what motivates leaders. So that's why we started this book.
Well, to take the subtitle of your book, so why exactly is bad behavior almost always good politics?
Well, the sort of number one rule that leaders should govern by is to be beholden to as small a number of people as they possibly can be. When you only have a few people to keep happy, it's very easy. You can just literally pay them. This is why dictatorships tend to be characterized by corruption. There's a small number of people who keep the guns trained on everybody else, for which they're massively rewarded. So this is a system of government that perpetuates leaders from to stay in office, because it's easier to stay in office in those kind of governments. But the policies that you want to enact in that kind of government are policies that aren't good for the people. They're corruption. You need to reward, you need to concentrate benefits in the hands of supporters and not focus on rewarding the average person on the street. So, leaders who try to act in the public benefit to the detriment of their supporters are going to always find themselves in trouble. So we can think of classic cases like Julius Caesar. I was always puzzled as a kid. Julius Caesar, this great man, wins all these wars, starts doing all kinds of reform, organizes the calendars, the roads, gets rid of debt in Rome, and they end up killing him for being the tyrant. Of course, he wasn't the tyrant. He was trying to be nice, but that's not what his friends wanted, so they killed him. And so this happens time and time again, is if leaders don't do what the coalition want, they won't be leader for very long. So I don't know if you want to – I mean, in the U.S. at the moment, we see this debate between the Republicans and the Democrats. And everyone's going to claim that they want to do is stimulate the economy. But if you actually look at the individual details of the plan, basically each side is trying their best to reward their supporters. The Republicans want to cut taxes. Why? Because rich people tend to be Republican supporters. So what they really want to do is cut services to the poor to feed the rich. And what do the Democrats want to do? Well, they want to tax the rich, aka Republicans, to feed the poor, aka Democrats. So it's a question of not worrying about public good, but worrying about what it is to keep you in power.
Well, I'm going to restrain myself, since I'm a good journalist, from asking you some of the provocative questions that you yourself ask and answer in your book, such as why do leaders who wreck their countries keep their jobs for so long, and why do evildoers so often collect loads of foreign aid? And I'm going to ask you this. Isn't your book going to make it easier for politicians to become dictators? It seems like you've almost written an instruction manual.
Right. So this is the horribly sad thing about this is the people who successfully come to power have long since figured out what we were saying. So the rhetoric might always be about promoting freedoms and bringing wealth and tranquility to the world. But the leaders that are successful have long since worked out what they need to do to stay in power. And, you know, we can look at people like Robert Mugabe, who took this beautiful, flourishing country of Zimbabwe and just turned it into a complete basket case. It went from a huge exporter to a huge importer of food. People are starving and dying all the time. But he knows who has to be paid, and the army are always the first to get paid. Cholera epidemics may spread through the country, but he always pays what needs to be done. So the part of the book that you might want to focus on, the cynical part, is that the despots have already worked out how to do this stuff. So part of the book is to explain why it is that despots do what they do, and why if we try and think about them doing things to promote the world as a better place, we just fail to understand what they're doing. But we actually, in the conclusions of the book, we spend a lot of time thinking about how it is that we can actually make the world better. When is it that we have leverage over despots to make them behave as better citizens?
And what do you conclude? How would you sum that up for our listeners?
Well, the first thing to think about is that we shouldn't be aiming for some super ideal. We shouldn't expect countries to immediately jump to be fully fledged democracies. What we got to do is start putting constraints on leaders, and we want to think about when leaders are vulnerable. So, you know, we can identify leaders as particularly vulnerable to change under a bunch of circumstances. So very old leaders, they're extremely vulnerable. Very new leaders who've just come to power, they're very vulnerable. So they can be coerced. Leaders who are broke, they are leaders that find it very difficult to stay in power, and they're willing to make the kind of difficult decisions that they need to, political reforms, in order to promote democratization and improvement of the society for their citizens. So we're big advocates of never give anybody money and resources and help up front in the expectation that they promise they will do reform. The moment we give a leader who's bankrupt money, they have money to pay their supporters. They no longer need to reform. We should only be rewarding leaders who've actually gone and made the difficult decision of making reform, liberalize their economies, allow the free media, allow the freedom of assembly. Those are the kind of leaders who've shown that they're willing to actually make reform by putting their control, their retention of power at jeopardy.
Now, Radio Free Europe has quite a few countries in our broadcast region that are ruled by dictators or authoritarian leaders. Alexander Lukashenko in Belarus, Islam Karimov in Uzbekistan, Gurbanguly Berdimuhamedov in Turkmenistan, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad in Iran. Many would put Russia's Putin and Medvedev on that list. What would you say to people living in these repressive, corrupt countries? What can they learn from your book to help them escape their situation?
The first thing to think about is how can you organize against the leader? So this is always the way. So communication, the ability of people to build human capital is absolutely key to undermining such systems. And then I think the second thing I would say is always be working on building communication, talking to people, getting ready for the time. But I think just turning up on the street and trying to protest at any particular moment is a poor thing to do, and is it likely? I think that just gets a lot of people killed. You know, I did a radio show a little while ago in Burma. Well, not in Burma, but for the Burmese liberalization. Guys were trying to liberalize in Burma, and I could tell that all the interviewer wanted me to do was tell the people to go on the streets, and I'm like, this is, you know, don't go on the streets because you're just going to get thumped. So I think the thing to do is build up human capital such that when the leadership is in a weakened position, we just saw in the Arab Spring, we had old leaders, we had bankrupt leaders, we had sickly leaders, and then when people went on the streets, then they had the human capital to organize. And because these leaders were in trouble, they didn't have money and they were old, the army sat on their hands and they were successful. Going out when the leader is youthful and can pay the army is just going to get a lot of people killed. So the unfortunate, sad thing, I think, is in the short term, I think, prepare and organize, build communication networks, speak to people, get as much information out as you can. But turning to the streets too early just gets a lot of people hurt.
Well, speaking of that, you mentioned the Arab Spring. Where did those rulers who have fallen or are in the midst of falling go wrong, as you see it?
Well, I mean, in some sense, they suffered from the classic problem we all do, is that they got old. So the real reason people stay loyal is leaders can reliably funnel rich rewards to them. A leader that gets sick, you know, is no longer in a position to be able to do this. This is an incredibly common pattern that people have these sort of draconian armed forces that keep suppressing the people year after year after year. And then suddenly, you know, there's an uprising and the army sit on its hands. So we could think about Marcos in the Philippines, Mobutu Sese Seko in Zaire. Each time there, everybody knew the gravy train had come to the end because the leader was out. You know, when you're dying, there's nothing you can do to pass things on. So when you're broke and when you're dying, people know that the end has come and they're looking around for what's the next gig in town. So that was what led them into trouble. A lot of the leaders there had also done a fair amount of reform. Egypt and Tunisia, their economies were both focused very much on tourism and commerce. And you can't have tourism and commerce unless people are allowed to talk to each other, meet freely. And the mere fact that you let people talk and interact means they don't just talk about, you know, how to get the tourists to the pyramids that the following afternoon. They might say, you know, and that social policy really sucks. And so that was another problem. But they were leaders that were beautifully constrained because they had no choice. But if they needed revenue, so they had to let the people talk.
Well, speaking of people getting killed on the street, how do you see things moving forward in places like Syria and Yemen right now?
Well, Syria is a case we've talked about a lot. So Syria, we think, is somewhere there's going to be political reform. We're not sure whether it will be under the Assad or not, but it's definitely a place that's highly likely to reform for the simple reason the people are reasonably well-educated and the economy increasingly relies on commerce. So foreign aid is virtually non-existent. The oil revenues are declining. The government runs around a 10% budget deficit, so it's desperate for funds. If you want to pay the army and you want to pay your supporters, you've got to raise money. The only place you can do it is let the people work. But getting the people to work involves letting them talk. And as we've seen, people have been able to organize very successfully in Syria. So we think this is a country that's highly likely to reform, whether under the current administration or under a successor one. We see this as a place that's going to reform. And, I mean, if we'd like to, I don't know if you want to take the time, but, you know, I think exactly the opposite is going to happen in Libya. That's a country where we think that, if anything, it's going to get more repressive than it has been.
In Libya?
In Libya, yeah, absolutely. So Libya is, in fact, you know, Gaddafi, I think if Gaddafi made one mistake, he was actually too kind. He had stopped cracking heads. So I was looking at data from Reporters Without Borders put out an index of press freedom. So 5 years ago, he was by far the most repressive regime in the region. 2010, so I looked at six countries. He was down at fourth, tied with Saudi Arabia. Only Egypt had more liberal press than him. Everybody else had been tightening the press. He'd been loosening it. He provided great education. Libya has a couple more years of expected education for children than his neighboring countries did. Here's a leader who actually didn't need the people to work because all of his revenues were coming from oil. So in some sense, he was enabling the people to organize and prepare against him when he didn't need to because he didn't need those revenues. So, you know, in some sense, yeah, he was a brutal man, and no doubt he killed thousands and thousands of people. But in recent years, he'd been paying too much attention to the people and not enough to cracking heads.
And why do you think that the current leadership there, the National Transitional Council, is not going to move ahead in a positive direction?
Well, we're already seeing billions of dollars in unfrozen assets flowing in. We're going to see billions of dollars in oil revenues flowing in. This is a government that has yet to go about the transitional council have yet to go about forming a government. There's lots of talk about elections. All revolutionaries talk about elections and freeing up things for the people, but very few of these regimes follow through. So they're going to have, I mean, literally billions of dollars, and they've got weapons to which to pay people. So they've got lots of money and they've got lots of weapons. They can pay people to keep everybody in line. And, you know, as I just sort of said, I think the lesson that we should learn from Gaddafi was that he was too nice. And I think it's a lesson that the Transitional Council, the National Transitional Council, are not going to make again. So I expect to see a lot of bloodshed there. There's going to be a lot of people get killed. There's going to be fights for who gets to the top. So, you know, there's one potential that no one manages to successfully seize power because too many groups are competing at the top, and we end up with a country breaking down like Somalia. There's lots of money to buy weapons. Or someone is going to get to the top eventually, and then we're just going to see purging of the ranks of former supporters, and we're going to see very few public goods provided. So I think we've replaced one dictator with could be a lot of bloodshed, and there'll be another dictator, and you know, I think maybe in 5 years' time, all that will be different is the lack of colorful clothes.
Goodness, that's a pretty bleak assessment.
Yeah, you know, I think that it was a complete failure of NATO policy. I think this is a place where they had very little chance of making a difference that was positive. We might dress it up that all they wanted was oil to flow out of Libya, but there were cheaper ways to get oil to flow out of Libya. So, I think it's pretty clear that Gaddafi would have stayed in power had the NATO jets not stopped his military from getting to the rebels.
Let me change the subject a little bit. It seems very easy in the West for the media to portray people like Gaddafi and the Belarusian leader Lukashenko as sort of eccentric rather than ruthless. Even the title of your book, The Dictator's Handbook, is rather flip. Is there a danger of trivializing dictatorship, sort of glossing over the miserable lives that the citizens in these countries lead?
Well, you know, this is how we view dictatorship. You know, when dictators do things that we like, we talk about stability and we praise them for being stable in the region. So for years, we propped up the Mubarak regime in Egypt. You know, so we were still giving them around $2 billion. Close to $2 billion a year until recently. You know, they've been in a high, in real terms, about $6 billion around the Camp David agreement. So we propped up that regime because it provided what we want, stability. And we were willing to overlook the kind of atrocities that were committed there. Regimes that we don't like Iran or the current Iranian regime, we again overlooked all the evils that took place under the previous monarchy, under the Shah. Regimes we don't like, we characterize it, their leaders as psychopaths, as evil people. And we have this sort of, if you do what we want, we're more than happy to overlook your lack of democracy. And, you know, and that's what U.S. leaders should do. So long as the people are delivering, foreign leaders deliver the policies that the U.S. public like or other backers like, then the president should be supporting them. He's delivering. That way the U.S. president can deliver the policies that we, the people of the United States, like. And that should be his job. But, you know, there is this huge disconnect between what we say and what we there's no flat level playing field by which we evaluate people.
Now, your book seems to implicate democracies as much as any other system of government in terms of, you know, they're obviously not immune from wholesale corruption and abuse. Could you talk about democracy and how it has no free license here?
Absolutely. Well, democracies, you know, we spend the first half of the book and we say, well, look, democracies do so much better things for their people. So, you know, the leaders provide, you know, longer life expectancies, more wealth, more health, more education, better quality of life across the board. And the reward for leaders is, of course, they get kicked out of office. But the reason we think that Democrats do this is not because Democrats are inherently better people, but they're constrained to keeping millions or tens of millions of voters happy. And you can't do that by handing out corrupt rewards that you can do in autocracy. So we're always thinking about why it is that leaders behave the way they do. So a leader goes overseas and we've got to worry about what you're going to do in some foreign nation. All leaders should really be worrying about, or what we assume that they worry about, is keeping their own jobs. So a leader has to go overseas and think, what do my supporters want from this country? If they want nothing from that country, then we're going to pretty much ignore that country. If we want something from that country, we're going to try and buy policy. If we can't buy policy through foreign aid, then we may think about organizing coups or revolutions there. And the system of government in that country is relatively, you know, is not the consideration we have at the end of the day. Leaders want to deliver for their supporters, not for the people of a foreign country. So am I being too cynical here?
No, not at all. But I'm afraid that's all the time we have. Alistair Smith, thank you very, very much for being on The Blender.
Yeah, you're more than welcome. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Grant. That was very interesting. I'm actually reading this book right now.
Just a reminder that The Blender is the weekly podcast from Radio Free Europe. RFE brings radio, internet, and television news programming to 21 countries across the former Soviet Union, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Iran, Iraq, and the Balkans. If you'd like to get in touch, it's very, very easy. Drop us a line at podcast@rferl.org. Or leave a comment on the Blender section of our website. And remember, you can download episodes of The Blender from our website or by subscribing on iTunes. A new episode is posted every Friday.
Now on to Iran. Its president, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, is now at the United Nations, sparking a wave of protests in New York City. Here to talk to me about Ahmadinejad's trip to America is our Washington correspondent covering Iran, Golnaz Isfandiari. Hello, Golnaz. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you, Pavel?
I'm very good, thank you. How is Washington treating you?
Very well, thank you. But I miss Prague.
We just listened to Grant Padalka's interview with the co-author of The Dictator's Handbook. And it just so happens that the president of Iran, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, is in New York right now, speaking at the United Nations. And I don't think I'd be wrong if I said that for many people, Ahmadinejad is a dictator. And he's often seen as this, at least in America for sure, wacky, eccentric person, you know, the butt of every joke. Especially last time he was in America when he was making all these comments about how, you know, there are no gays in Iran. And he was talked about on every late night show. But the one note I want to make is that I think pretty often in the Western mind, these dictators are just wacky, eccentric individuals, and we don't really see behind all those idiosyncrasies and escapades the real trouble that the real people are in. And I guess it is a lot of fun mocking foreign dictators, you know, wearing a Gaddafi-style uniform to a Charlie Sheen roast or laughing at the malapropisms of Belarus leader Alexander Lukashenko. But if you live in a 500-square-foot apartment outside Minsk with four other people and spend most of your salary on basic food, when your rights are trampled on a daily basis, all these escapades by your wacky dictator seem a lot less amusing. So that's my comment. But so speaking of Ahmadinejad, Golnaz, what is it that you find particularly interesting about this visit?
The interesting point about the visit is that President Ahmadinejad is in New York with his very controversial aide, Isfandiar Rahim Mashaei. And it's amazing that U.S. media are not paying attention to that. They're just, you know, giving Ahmadinejad exactly what he wants. He loves attention.
What's
getting
so controversial
that in New York.
About this person?
Mr. Ahmadinejad is in trouble in Iran over a power struggle with the supreme leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, and his allies. And all those people are attacking mostly Ahmadinejad's aide, his right-hand man, Mr. Esfandiar Mashoi, who they accused of having bewitched Ahmadinejad. They accused him of trying to push for a plan to sort of limit the role of the clergy in Iran. So he's being blamed for everything. And there's been many calls for him to be arrested in Iran. And it's interesting that
what charges?
He could... different charges. Now his name has surfaced over this embezzlement case, banking scandal, that and other issues in the past. So one lawmaker said that Ahmadinejad took him with him to New York so he prevents him from being arrested in Iran while he's away. But it's also interesting, it shows that President Ahmadinejad, despite all the pressure he's facing inside the country, he's not ready to back off, and he's standing by his aide, Mr. Rahim Mashoi.
Well, that tells you something about the nature of the political system in Iran, which maybe doesn't make Ahmadinejad the real dictator of that country.
Very good point, Pavel. He's not. The real dictator is Khamenei, Ahmadinejad's boss, or the supreme leader of Iran, who has the last say in the Islamic Republic, and who observers say that he was the man who was instrumental in bringing Ahmadinejad to power. But Mr. Ahmadinejad hasn't been an easy president. He's been fighting back, which has been unusual in the Islamic Republic. Other presidents have been not as combative and as President Ahmadinejad.
And before his trip, he made a few appearances on American television. Is that right?
Yes.
What was the message that he was trying to get across?
Well, the main message, he said that he's going to release the U.S. hikers or the U.S. Citizens who were detained in Iran on charges of illegally entering the country and espionage charges also they were facing. They were just released, as you know, yesterday. They were reunited with their families and right before President Ahmadinejad is going to speak at the U.N. So the timing was perfect for him. But what he said in those interviews before his trip to New York was that he made it look that he's basically pardoning them. But then later the judiciary came out and said that they didn't let them go, and it took a few days before that happened. So some people said that that was part of the power struggle, that the judiciary was making sure that Ahmadinejad doesn't get all the credit for the release of those two American citizens who were jailed in Iran for 2 years, more than 2 years.
Is this media campaign working out for him? What's the feedback from the American public?
Particularly one piece that was aired on NBC was I think, a big sort of PR piece for Ahmadinejad, because it was NBC said that this is a look in behind the scenes of the life of Ahmadinejad, who's a very controversial leader in the international scene. And basically that report was very flattering if you watch that. You know, it was like that President Ahmadinejad works all the time and he's just a very extremely caring person. He travels to all these places to care about the poor people. So that was, I think, even Ahmadinejad's PR team couldn't have done a better job.
Ahead of his trip, Ahmadinejad said that one of his main priorities at the United Nations is proposing ways to reform global management.
Yes, this is so, Mr. Ahmadinejad. He's not dealing with the problems his country face. You know, many people accuse him and his government of mismanagement of the economy, and they believe that under his presidency, the economy has gotten worse and the country is facing more and more problems. But President Ahmadinejad, instead of finding some solutions for those problems, he comes to New York with this plan to reform the global management.
Does he have a friendly audience in the United Nations?
I don't think so. I don't think, you know, during his past speeches, we've seen people walk out when he started speaking about the Holocaust and other issues. So in general, I don't think there are many people who are friendly towards him. Of course, he has his allies, countries such as Venezuela and others. But I think other countries are not particularly friendly to Ahmadinejad and very receptive to what he's planning to say.
Let me ask you this. Every time he goes to the United States to speak at the United Nations, there's all kinds of protests waged by various groups. And this time around, he's not getting any love in New York either. Is there anything in particular that struck you as interesting about these current protests?
There's been a campaign before he traveled to New York, but that was also last year, asking hotels not to give him a room. But obviously it didn't work. He has a room. He's staying somewhere. I received some information that I think when he'll be speaking at the UN during his speech, they're planning to do a mock wedding of President Ahmadinejad and President Assad from Syria.
Yeah, I heard about that. There's a page, a Facebook page, I think it's called Iran 180. Is that right? Or
yes.
Yeah, and they posted
exactly.
a rap clip. But
yes, there's a rap music video also they've created. Obviously, Iranians also have been protesting his visit to New York. We've talked to people who have traveled to New York from other cities in the U.S. to protest. And as you said, you know, it might seem amusing with some of his comments to a Western audience. But to Iranians who are inside the country, who are, you know, facing those problems and living in a closed society, it's not so amusing. For example, I think President Ahmadinejad has said in one of his interviews that there are no political prisoners in Iran. This is what all Iranian officials said, that we don't have any political prisoners, because basically what those people who are jailed in Iran for over their political activism are jailed on security charges. But it doesn't mean that there are no political prisoners.
Well, you know what? Maybe he's not the real dictator in that country, but he can certainly give some tips to any aspiring dictator anywhere in the world. Well, thank you, Gulnaz. That was very interesting. As always, it was a pleasure to have you on the show. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Well, that's our show. Send your comments and questions to podcast@referl.org or go to the podcast page on our website at referl.org and leave a comment. Also, look me up on Twitter. I tweet under Rus Police Watch, that's RUS Police Watch, all one word, which stands for Russian Police Watch. I cover mostly Russian police and security affairs, but not only. Many thanks to Grant Podelko, Gulnaz Isfandiaryan, and our producer Tanya Kancheva. My name is Pavel Batorin. Thanks for turning on the blender. Check for a new episode next week. Until then, take care. And let's pay tribute once again to REM. I'm going to leave you with Losing My Religion. Man, I used to love this song.
Life is bigger. It's bigger. I said it.